Lecture 3. Mahavira and Jainism, Extreme Nonviolence.
Hello again. In the last lecture, I introduced the classical Indian Vedas and the Upanishads with their characteristic teachings of monism. Remember that Atman and Brahman are the same thing, that your innermost self and ultimate reality are the same, along with the terms samsara, reincarnation, karma, cosmic justice, dharma, duty or morality, and moksha, liberation. That package of ideas turned out to be a very powerful combination, fueling Hinduism and the six orthodox philosophies that are associated with that religious tradition. But not everybody in India was convinced. Remember the discussions in the Darshana Hotel. For the next two lectures, we're going to talk about the two most significant heresies, the unorthodox traditions, and those are Buddhism and Jainism. They're heresies in that they reject the authority of the Vedas, as well as the speculations and the sacrifices of the Brahmin priests. But first, I want to talk about a third heresy, Charvaka. We sometimes think of India as a particularly spiritual place, and indeed, most of the prominent thinkers and philosophies have been concerned with religious answers to life's questions. It's not because no one ever thought to question those assumptions. The Charvaka school is one of the most irreligious, skeptical systems of thought ever devised, and it comes out of ancient India. Okay. It is true that the school didn't exactly thrive. The earliest texts dating back to 600 BC have been lost, but it was influential for some time. And from what we can piece together from scattered references and later works, these thinkers posited a type of materialism in which the only things that could be perceived directly, only those things were thought to exist. So you had to, it had to come through the senses. If it couldn't be heard or seen or touched, it didn't exist. So according to Charvaka philosophers, there's no soul, no reincarnation, no gods. In fact, they said that religion is a fraud devised by men to take advantage of others. Charvaka was also known by the term Lokayata, where loka means this world. And they said, what we imagine as a soul or a consciousness is simply a side effect of having a healthy body. When the body dies, consciousness disappears. There's no existence apart from a physical body. Now, the parallels with materialistic philosophies in the West, such as Epicureanism, are rather striking. So if this life is all there is, there's no purpose or meaning, if ideas of right and wrong are simply human conventions that make no difference whatsoever to the cosmos, how should we live? And Charvaka philosophers said, you just do the best you can. Enjoy pleasures where they're possible and avoid pain. There's really nothing else to worry about. All right, so as you can see, there's this huge variety of speculation from the profoundly religious ideas of the Upanishads to the uncompromising materialism of Charvaka. And into this world of debate and discussion and turmoil, intellectual turmoil, comes Mahavira, the founder of Jainism. He wasn't known as Mahavira when he was born. I mean, Mahavira is a title that means the great hero. His name was Vardhamana. And he was born into the Kshatriya caste, so this is the rulers, the warrior ruler caste, in northeastern India in about the 6th century BC. The traditional dates are 599 to 527 BC, though recent scholarship moves this forward by about half a century to maybe 540 to 468 BC. This was a time of political and social change. Ancient clan ties were giving way to larger regional kingdoms. Trade and wealth was increasing, cities were getting larger, and there was a greater disparity between rich and poor that was being noticed by a lot of people. And it started to bother a lot of people. With Mahavira, documented information about his life is rather hard to come by. But the traditions are that he was raised as a prince. He was, in fact, the second son of a king. And he was raised in luxury and in wealth. From an early age, he was deeply interested in spiritual matters, and he was dissatisfied with the life that he saw around him, the increasing inequities and the turmoil and the warfare that he saw. At about the age of 30, after his parents died, he gave up his kingdom, Okay, he has an older brother who's going to be the heir, but he gives up any claim to royal privileges. He gives up his possessions. He gives up his family. And for the next 12 years, he wanders around as an ascetic, right? Someone who denies himself physical pleasures in a quest for spiritual progress. He fasts. He meditates until finally, at the age of 42, he gained full enlightenment. And at that point, he became a Jinna. It means a conqueror. And he was known as Mahavira. Jains see him, Mahavira, as the 24th and last Tirthankara. That means a ford finder, right? So the world is imagined as a terrible river of suffering and misery, and he finds a way across it. Okay, he doesn't build a bridge. I mean, he gets across it, and then you have to follow his path. And the word Jain means a follower of the Jinnas. You're going to follow the Mahavira's example. So for the rest of his days, maybe 30 more years, Mahavira taught others what he had learned about the great questions of life. He accepted the doctrine of samsara, reincarnation, but with a slight twist, and one that makes a tremendous difference in everything else. Rather than believing that only humans and animals and gods have souls, Mahavira taught that nearly everything is alive. Everything is made up of jiva, a little living intelligences, trapped in matter. And he divided the world of living beings, which is almost everything, into five great categories. There are beings with five senses, the regular five senses that we usually talk about, and that includes humans and larger animals. And then there are creatures with four senses, so they can't hear, and that includes flies and wasps and butterflies. And then you're down to three sense animals, so they're deaf and blind. It includes ants and fleas and moths. I guess moths flying into candle flames made it seem like they couldn't see very well. And then two sense animals with only taste and touch, and those include worms and leeches and shellfish. And then finally, creatures that have just one sense of touch, and these are plants, microscopic organisms, earth like dirt clods, wind, water, drops, and fires. This is by far the largest category. And the one thing that they all have in common is that they can all feel pain, right? Their whole existence is to be able to feel pain. A modern scholar has described it in this way. Let's see here. Thus, the whole world is alive. In every stone on the highway, a soul is locked, so tightly enchained by matter that it cannot escape the careless foot that kicks it or cry out in pain, but it's capable of suffering nevertheless. When a match is struck, a fire being with a soul which may one day be reborn in a human body is born, only to die a few moments afterwards. In every drop of rain, in every breath of wind, in every lump of clay is a living soul. Sometimes when I teach my classes about this, I ask if there's anybody who's a smoker who might have a lighter with them, and then ask them to produce a little flame, and then it goes out, and I point out that was a soul that was born as a flame and then died as a flame that may be reborn someday as maybe as a student of mine someday. Okay, there's another ancient Jain scripture that asks you to imagine the infinite number of times that you have been hunted and torn apart when you were a deer, or caught with hooks and nets and scaled and gutted when you were living as a fish, or when you were a tree, you were chopped down and stripped of your bark and cut into planks, or when you were a piece of iron, you were pounded and beaten every day. It says, always in fear and pain and suffering without a moment's reprieve, life after life. So there's no all-encompassing Brahman. Instead, there's an infinite number of souls that are eternally distinct, and they're caught in this endless cycle of agony. But it's not exactly endless, because Mahavira also taught a version of karma and moksha. In his conception, karma, which is cosmic justice, remember, was an almost material quality. So cruel and thoughtless acts attracted a heavy karma, almost like clouds of of sticky, dark, but still invisible materials that weigh down a soul at the time of death and send it down to the lower realms of existence. Whereas acts of kindness and generosity resulted in a lighter soul, which then can move up this ladder of existence. By acts of self-sacrifice, you can work off this bad, heavy karma, so that the goal is to accept suffering for yourself, but not to cause other people to suffer. And if you can do that, you can eventually be freed altogether from matter and from samsara. So rather than killing mosquitoes that landed on him, Mahavira would willingly share his blood with them and let them fly off. Or while he was wandering around, other ascetics would carry staffs with him so they could keep off dogs. But Mahavira, according to the traditions, just let dogs bite him rather than actually inflict harm or inflict pain upon them. Mahavira took this principle of ahimsa, and it means nonviolence or doing no harm. So ahimsa is a key word in Jainism. He takes that principle to its logical extreme. Eventually, he doesn't wear any clothes because even the clothes that we wear come from the cotton or flax or some living creature that's had to suffer so that we could manufacture it into clothes that we could wear. So he just goes naked. And then he also, in the end, starves himself to death at the age of 72. So you get more bad karma from eating larger animals, less for eating smaller, even less for eating vegetables, but you still get some bad karma. So he just eats nothing at all and then goes into nirvana. Through an arduous process of purification through self-denial and self-mortification, all karma from past actions is exhausted, and when a person dies, he or she enters into the state of nirvana, never to be reborn again. Now, nirvana is not quite like the Christian notion of heaven. It has no material attributes whatsoever. You can't talk about, you know, streets paved with gold or whatever. But nirvana is described as a state in which the soul has four things, according to Mahavira: infinite knowledge, infinite perception, infinite energy, and infinite bliss. So if everything is alive and you want to avoid the bad karma that comes from causing suffering to other living creatures, how do you act? Or perhaps more importantly, what do you not do? Okay, you don't want to cause suffering. All Jains take the five great vows. No violence, that's ahimsa. No stealing. No sexual immorality. No falsehood. And no grasping, right? This is non-attachment. In addition, there are two broad spiritual paths available. There's the ordinary path and the extraordinary path. So regular Jains practice vegetarianism. Remember, you want to eat as low in the food chain as possible. They are monogamous. They limit acquisitions and wealth by charity, by giving away extra possessions that they have. They limit their travel. They observe special periods of fasting, of meditation. Sometimes they sweep the ground in front of them so they don't accidentally step on little creatures. At times they might wear face masks so you don't accidentally breathe in little creatures and thus injure them, kill them. They strain their water, and they also don't eat at night. Okay, I guess you don't eat at night because if it's dark and you can't exactly see, you may accidentally bite something and swallow something living. And they don't eat root vegetables. No potatoes, no garlic, no onions or carrots. Okay, that might seem a little strange, but the idea there is that those root vegetables have very complex souls that have lots of souls within them, and you also have to kill them in order to harvest them. So stay away from those. By tradition, Jains avoided farming. Instead, they became merchants or bankers. And they lived these very strict lifestyles, but the religion survived. And they found that as merchants, sometimes they did a little better, had a little more prosperity than their Hindu farming neighbors. So there's still Jains around today, maybe 4 or 5 million in the world. They're a little bit hard to count because sometimes they are counted in among Hindus. But the honesty of Jain businessmen is proverbial. Okay, I said there were two paths. The ordinary path, where you just try to live the best you can, get a good afterlife, and move up gradually. And then there's the extraordinary path, where you want to end this existence now, in this life. And that's what you would take as a monk or as a nun. So no family, so no sexual immorality means celibacy, strict celibacy. They wander about from place to place. They don't get attached to a place. They don't own a home. They walk wherever they go. They're barefoot. They beg for food and just accept whatever people manage to give them. They suffer all insults without response. And then occasionally, they may choose to follow Mahavira and starve themselves to death at the end of their life. I mean, that's the highest good. Eventually, there were arguments about some of these practices. And consequently, there were two divisions of Jains that came up, each with their own version of the Jain scriptures. There were the Digambaras, which are sky-clad monks. Sky-clad means the only clothes they have are air. Okay, they wear absolutely nothing. It's only men who do this. And they also eat with their hands. I mean, they don't use utensils at all. And they also say that there's no enlightenment for women. So a woman will do the best she can. She's not going to be a sky-clad monk. But maybe in the next life, she can be reborn as a man and then go into nirvana from there, achieve enlightenment, then moksha. And then there are also the Svetambaras, and those, they wear, the monks and nuns wear a sort of light white clothing, and in this one, women can achieve moksha. So moksha, or liberation, comes at the end of a 14-stage process. Okay, I won't go through all 14 stages, but basically these are steps towards enlightenment. And these lists of places you should be make it seem more rational or scientific. I mean, it's sort of like physics, where you start out, you know, with certain kinds of math and understanding, and then move on in a regular progression. Faith comes in stage number 4 from a flash of insight. So you don't adopt this difficult, stringent lifestyle just out of blind faith. But gradually, your motivation increases as you gain a little more insight that comes from progressing along this path toward ultimate enlightenment. Jainism might seem extreme, but there's a lot to admire in this. It is a sort of religious extremism, but it's directed against oneself rather than against other people. I mean, sometimes, in some Western traditions, you show how devoted you are to God by going out and killing heretics or persecuting others. And in this one, your devotion is all directed toward yourself. There's also a tradition that Mahavira ties into. Remember, he's from the priestly caste. Now, once you become a Jain, caste doesn't matter. But he comes from that tradition of great conquest. And rather than military or political conquest, which was his class tradition, he instead moves towards spiritual conquest, right? Ahimsa, nonviolence, renunciation, asceticism. It's difficult. You have to be disciplined. Those are all good warrior caste virtues. Except for Mahavira, this path is open to everyone. I like the way that it's rational and consistent. I mean, the metaphysics leads to the ethics. If you believe that the whole world is alive and is capable of feeling pain, then the way that Mahavira asks you to live makes perfect sense. And the emphasis on ahimsa, on nonviolence, is also attractive. It influenced Mahatma Gandhi. He grew up in an area where he knew Jains and admired their moral principles. There's a keen awareness of suffering that comes in this religion. Christianity also has a concern for the poor and for the afflicted, but not perhaps to the same extent. Now, Jainism is going to avoid a big problem in many monotheistic religions, which is the problem of theodicy. How can a God be all-powerful and all-loving and still produce a world in which there's so much suffering? Okay, there are complicated explanations for that in Western traditions. But in Jainism, that's not a problem because the world wasn't created by a God. These little alive beings have always existed. This is just the way it is, and he's showing the way to end that. And then there's a tradition of literature and scholarship in the followers of Mahavira. To illustrate, let me tell you two Jain stories. The first one is going to illustrate the pervasiveness of suffering and the power of desire to keep souls in karmic bondage. So the story is, there was a poor man who left home to find a better life. He got lost in the thick forest. He's hungry, he's thirsty, he's afraid. And then suddenly he sees an elephant, actually a rather large elephant, and this is a deranged elephant that's charging him with an upraised trunk. And he turns, and at the same time, he sees an ugly, evil demoness who's laughing loudly and holding a sword. So he's caught between the two, and terrified, he runs for a banyan tree and tries to climb it, but then he finds he can't climb it because the lower limbs are too far off the ground. And so he jumps down into a well that just happened to be nearby, and he's hanging there, actually on the side of the well, hanging on to a clump of reeds growing out of its wall. And he's hoping to prolong his life, if only for a few minutes. He looks down below, and there are horrible snakes at the bottom of this well. It's sort of an old, dried-up well, and a giant python that hisses and opens its mouth. And the man thinks, I'm only going to live as long as these reeds hold out. But when he raises his eyes and up to the reeds, he sees two mice that are gnawing at the roots of the clump of reeds, and the wild elephant, enraged, butts the tree, the banyan tree, again and again, until a beehive that was hung over the well was dislodged. It falls down, hits the man on the head, he's stung by a swarm of angry bees, and then by chance, a drop of honey from the honeycomb in the hive falls on his head, rolls down his face, and into his mouth. And he tastes that momentary sweetness, and he forgets everything. He forgets the elephant and the demon and the pit and the snakes and the bees. And he thinks, this is kind of tasty. Can I get some more of this? Commentators explained that the elephant is death. The demoness is old age. Right? This is an allegory. The tree is salvation, which is unobtainable for ordinary men on the ordinary path. The well is life. And the snakes are passions down at the bottom. The mice are the weeks that eat away at your life, and the stinging bees are diseases. The honey, of course, represents trivial pleasures, which should be inconsequential to those who understand the whole situation, like how perilous and how tormenting this all is. But those trivial pleasures sometimes seem so irresistible. And the point of the story is you should give up those minor pleasures and look around and see what's actually happening. You need to escape from the terrors and the terrible situation of this life. Don't be suckered by the little joys and pleasures that may come your way occasionally. Okay, I promise you two stories from Jain literature. The second story is the familiar story of the blind man and the elephant. And it's a story that gets told in some other Indian traditions, but it's prominent in Jainism. So, once there was a king, and he was perhaps trying to be funny as a practical joke, he brought together five blind men and asked each of them to touch an elephant and then describe the beast based on his experience. The first man, who touched the elephant's trunk, said, elephants are like snakes. And the second one, who grabbed a tail, said, no, it feels more like a rope to me. And then there was one who felt the side of the elephant and said, it feels like a wall. And then one who put his arms around the leg and said, no, elephants are more like pillars. And then the fifth, feeling the ear of the elephant, said, elephants are like winnowing fans. The men soon fell to arguing heatedly, since each of them was sure from his own direct experience that what he had said was right. Now, of course, all of them were right, but only in a partial way, from their own limited perspective. Okay, that's a simple enough story. And one that's been retold many times in several traditions. But for Jains, it illustrates a sophisticated philosophical critique of ordinary epistemology. Remember, epistemology is the science of how we know what we know, the study of how we know what we know. And there's a number of Jain philosophers that do a lot of analysis along these lines. They developed the theory of many-sidedness, which acknowledges that the world is complex, that there are multiple viewpoints, each of which may be partially true. Therefore, rather than confidently pronouncing that X is Y, a thoughtful observer should restrict their assertions to X may be Y. At least that's the way it seems to me, or more precisely. Relative to a certain standpoint and to a certain aspect, this object appears, let's say, blue. Okay, they don't say this is blue. All judgments are limited and tentative. There's no single perspective from which reality can be completely comprehended. When a disciple asked Mahavira if the world is finite or infinite, he explained that from the perspective of substance, it's one. And because of that, it can be counted, and so it's finite, right? There's just one world. It's also finite in terms of its area, which has to do with Jain cosmology and the way they thought about the cosmos. At the same time, Mahavira answered, it's infinite with regard to time. And it's also infinite from the standpoint of modification, given the countless modifications of color, of taste, of smell, shape, weight, and so on, that the world encompasses. So it's both finite and infinite at the same time. It depends on the perspective that you view it from. Mahavira's ideas on the doctrine of viewpoints and the doctrine of maybe are developed much further by his disciples over the centuries. But if you think about it, does it really make sense for Jains to argue heatedly about anything? The principle of ahimsa, or nonviolence, is much better served by agreeing to disagree. Truth is relative to a certain perspective. Surely there's some sense in which everyone is right, at least partially, just as there are ways in which everyone is wrong. And why fight about it? It just wouldn't be the Jain way. So now we come to the big questions. Remember, I talked about these in the first lecture. What is the nature of reality? How do we know what we know? How should we live? Why do people suffer? How can we find happiness? And Mahavira gave answers to each of those questions. And you might think about how the answers that he gave might be applicable in our lives. It's a thought question. Does our happiness ever depend on the suffering of others? I have two children, and both of them are adopted. And I have gained a great deal of delight in being a father, in watching my children grow and develop and mature. But when I watch that and enjoy that, I'm always aware that somewhere in the world are two mothers who at the same time are missing children that they gave up for adoption. Now, it was a freely chosen sort of thing. I think it probably works out in the best interest of everyone. But there's always that understanding that there's a different perspective there. Think about sporting events. To the exact degree that you are elated when your team wins, somebody else is disappointed when their team loses. And that's true in all competition. Think of how much competition there is in life for jobs, for partners, for grades. Think about where the goods that you enjoy come from, your clothes, your food, toys that you give your children. And oftentimes, they come at the end point of a long production process that sometimes involves a fair amount of suffering for people, from a Jain perspective, even for things. As I've said, Mahavira offers a keen awareness of the pervasiveness of suffering, but also an example of how to escape being complicit in it. Remember that he's a Ford finder. He shows you the way out of this comprehensive world of suffering and sorrow. You have to follow his example, and his example is based on ahimsa. Mahavira taught a rather impressive way of life. It's disciplined, it's rational, it may even be noble, but it was actually too much for many people. It was just too difficult to actually practice. Even the ordinary norm, as opposed to those who wanted to become Jain monks and nuns. And that's why Mahavira's followers were eventually outnumbered by those of his near contemporary, the Buddha, who taught the middle way between regular life and what he saw as extreme asceticism. And we're going to talk about that in the next lecture, when we pick up Buddha and the doctrines that he taught. I'll see you then.